Didn't know he was in the building. He's here talking with a lot of folks today. We have two bills we're going to hear today, and we're going to start off with Article 5 of it's for Senate File 145. It's Article 5 of the Governor's Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. And to get us started, we're going to hear from Deputy Commissioner of Energy and Telecommunications, Edward Garvey. Welcome, Mr. Garvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me get myself sort of organized here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Edward Garvey. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to address the committee on Article 5 of the Governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative Proposal, Senate File 145. The Governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative has three main parts. They break down into the category of more renewables, more efficiency, and less carbon. The topic that I want to address today in that part of that bill, that is Article 5, is dealing with the less carbon. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, climate change poses a real threat, raising important long-range public policy issues for Minnesota. The concentration of atmospheric CO2 is increasing. Credible scientific evidence links the increased CO2 concentrations to human activity. This increase is likely to change and may already be changing the world's climate, posing a significant threat to Minnesota, the United States, and the global community. Governor Pawlenty believes it is in Minnesota's best interest to develop a comprehensive, responsible, deliberative, and enduring ways to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. Article 5 of Senate File 145 does this, but before walking through those provisions, I would like to explain to the committee the thinking that went into those provisions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, while we believe climate change is real, we recognize that there are uncertainties. How much will the climate change? How fast will that change occur? What will be the impact of that change on Minnesota and the nation and the region? Can we see such changes today? And what does it all mean for Minnesota? As we have crafted our approach, we recognize that Minnesota did not create this problem, nor can we solve it by ourselves. Climate change is a global problem requiring global and national solutions. Although Minnesota can and should address its contributions, it should not do so in ways that unfairly disadvantage our citizenry or industries. Similarly, Mr. Chairman, we recognize that this problem cannot be solved overnight and believe it is counterproductive to try. We need to make sure we do the right thing in the right way. Today's solutions should not become tomorrow's problems. There are many positive ways to address climate change. For example, our tentative analysis of the soon-to-be-enacted 25x25 renewables law, which this committee very rightfully should be proud of having passed several weeks ago and is on its way to the governor's desk after action last night on the House floor, is that carbon emissions from the state's electricity sector may stabilize as a result of that legislation. This is a very, very significant achievement. Improving the state's energy efficiency efforts, as suggested by the governor's Next Generation Energy Initiative, will go even further in that very positive direction. Additional climate change solutions need creative, beyond government thinking. To paraphrase Einstein, we cannot solve today's problems with yesterday's thinking. It will take new and different ways of doing things to address climate change. This requires a deliberative, bottom-up approach. Such an approach is reinforced by the fact that everyone contributes to the problem, so everyone must be made part of the solution. Accordingly, an inclusive process that assures that all interested people, industries, and economic sectors can and do participate in its solutions is needed to come up with the creative and comprehensive ways to reduce Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions. Such a stakeholder process is the cornerstone of Governor Pawlenty's less carbon proposal in his Next Generation Energy Initiative. Although this effort is already underway, we do ask that it be codified in Section 4 of Article 5 of Senate File 145. Sections 1, 2, and 3 of Article 5 apply to new fossil fuel electricity generating facilities. We expect them to offset their additional greenhouse gas emissions before getting a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission. The offsets can be achieved by capturing and then sequestering the facility's carbon emissions, the purchasing or trading of greenhouse gas credits, or by some other offsetting mechanisms approved by the PUC. Governor Pawlenty also wants the state of Minnesota as an operating entity to take steps to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we are already gathering our state's data and evaluating the merits of joining the Chicago Climate Exchange. The fourth component of the governor's initiative is to work with our neighboring states to collectively reduce our emissions. This idea is found in Subdivision 2, Section 4 of Article 5. Work on this is already, again, on its way, and we will report back to you in a year on our success. To conclude, climate change is a real threat, posing difficult public policy choices. Minnesota can and should address its CO2 emissions, and Governor Pawlenty has offered a comprehensive, responsible, deliberative, and enduring way using a bottoms-up stakeholder process hosted by the Center for Climate Strategies to do this. That is the foundation of Article 5. That is a very important part of the way we think we should address this very important threat to Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committees, for this opportunity to address you. I'll sit for any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Garvey. Any questions from the members? Senator Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, my question goes to the A, B, and C of Section 2. The applicant has arranged where they can arrange to offset their carbon dioxide emissions. The capturing and sequestration of these emissions, can you kind of go a little bit into that technology, the status of that technology? I know it's being developed, is my understanding, but I'm wondering how far that is and any kind of cost estimates associated with that.
Mr. Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Cook. The capture and capturing of CO2 and the greenhouse gas emissions from an emitting facility, and then the sequestration of it is a very, very promising technology, from my understanding. I am not the world's expert on that. There are others in the audience, and I believe you will have other witnesses who can explain and expound on that in more detail. What I will say is that is one of our options. It's probably the most effective or deemed to be the most effective, sure way of dealing with an emission or preventing the emission of a greenhouse gas, is the capture of it and then the subsequent sequestration of it. As the governor's provision indicated, it is one of the options that we would suggest that a proposer of an electrical generation facility fueled by fossil fuels would look at in its proposal and its offset options. There are certainly other options, the trading and the crediting, and any other mechanism that they would come up with working with us that we would bring to the Public Utilities Commission to address that. And cost would be certainly one of the factors of one of the choices that they would make of those three.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on the same section, Deputy Commissioner Garvey. My concern is about item C, the one you just touched on, another method approved by the commission after notice and opportunity to comment. I'm just now reading an article here about, not all offsets are created equal, and you know, there's this kind of open market for offsets that consumers can buy to you know, offset their otherwise, you know, fairly expansive CO2 producing lifestyle, driving SUVs or flying airplanes all over the place and that sort of thing. And there's a growing skepticism about about those kinds of offsets. So I'm just a little concerned. I mean, I know I love the PUC. They do great work, but I'm concerned that you know, outside of a cap and trade system, outside of a real way to validate and verify and certify that we're not actually producing more CO2, that you know, we won't have a real tight system for assuring that we've got real offsets. So I'm wondering if you have a response to how we might be able to tighten that up a little bit.
Mr. Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Dibble. You're touching on a very, very important topic and one that we've given a great deal of thought to. And there's, in our assessment, there's sort of perfect world solutions or solutions that will be made available to us in the future, but aren't available to us now or aren't available to us in a perfect world. And we can sort of go there and be ironclad in that offset concept. But that's not where we are now. And that's not what we're expecting to hold our facilities to right now. What we're expecting our facilities to is to start addressing the greenhouse gas emissions. Ideally, a technology such as capture and sequestration would be really. Ideally, there'd be mechanisms of trading and crediting kind of setups. Those aren't necessarily available, both technologically and organizationally. And so we need to look at other options. Our solution to that is to give us the maximum flexibility to create those offsets, to figure out the way to at least moving the ball forward to address those kinds of facilities. And we think that using the Public Utilities Commission, using the public input process, would allow us to maximize the flexibility, craft a set of solutions that does address the carbon emissions, does so in an economic and thoughtful way based upon the situation that we're confronted today, but not necessarily locking it in and making it impossible for these facilities to get built.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I appreciate that, Commissioner Garvey. I agree. You know, we shouldn't foreclose. We should be realistic about what's currently available and get people moving along the road of actual CO2 reductions. That's really my concern. Is that, we'll have some of these. I mean, these have to do with people are buying offsets for stuff that may not actually be happening or may not really be having a. Some sort of measurable overall reduction in CO2. So I'm wondering, maybe we don't need to get to an ironclad, unrealistic language, but maybe there's some opportunity to tighten up some of the language in lines 23.24 and 0.25, so there at least some measure of some way to measurably verify and validate that we're achieving what I think is the shared goal of reducing CO2. I mean, some of these examples I read about in this article, and I'd be happy to share it with the committee. There is properly a great deal of skepticism about whether folks are collecting money for actual offsets or just collecting money to put in their pocket. So,
Mr. Garvey, you'd like to respond?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Dibble, our view is that the offsets that would be approved by the commission would need to be a credible, real steps in the right direction. The evidence that would have to be supported and presented. But one of the things that we are very concerned about right now is not to give the flexibility to be able to be creative in how to achieve those. We're going into an area where we do need to be creative. We do need to think beyond the standard ways of operating. We want to encourage people to be creative. The way we've sort of worked it and phrased it is to give us that opportunity, notice and comment. The public gets to sort of decide. The substance will basically bear itself out.
But, Mr. Chair, I know the PUC also appreciates some clarity from the legislature about its intent when it passes legislation, and you know, and I think has properly critiqued us for being overly vague and not giving much direction when we're asking them to do something. So I'll just leave it at that. I think we share the goals. I think the goals are mutual, and you know, perhaps some more descriptive language would help.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Deputy Commissioner Garvey, just to follow up, I guess what I've heard of the concern about planting trees somewhere in the world as an offset, which might be beneficial, but how, I mean, you need to guarantee those will be around as long as the plant is, for example, or the emitter of CO2. I mean, is that something that you would have as a criteria, that have to be permanent offsets, for example?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Anderson. No, they would not necessarily have to be permanent. Here's why. We think that there will be mechanisms to being developed in the future that will be more effective than solutions we can develop today. So what we would want in one scenario would be to start working on using today's solutions than today's ideas. When better ideas come along, you'd want to take advantage of those rather than locking in on a permanent, necessarily a permanent basis. So, I mean, and maybe this is a semantical argument of what is permanent. But the question that we're trying to sort of struggle with is to make sure that we sort of start working on this issue today. We start doing something about greenhouse gas emissions. At the same time, understanding that our abilities are limited today and will only get better. And so that start is what's important, and making sure we have the flexibility to take advantage of future superior alternatives and the superior approaches is also important. And that's one reason why we want to sort of preserve the flexibility in the language that we've offered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Garvey, I appreciate the intent. I guess it would be helpful, I think, to have some kind of guidance or criteria about what we're hoping to achieve, so that we can ensure that offsets are real. And so it seems to me the legislature would have to put some guidance there. I mean, if somebody agreed to plant trees and then, you know, 5 years later they chopped them all down, then what? I mean, if we have flexibility, what you're saying is that if there's better technology later, we should be able to adapt to that, and I think that makes really good sense. But we need to have some kind of accountability or monitoring to make sure that we get to that, and we don't just have offsets that don't mean anything a short time later.
Mr. Garvey?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Anderson. I think the question that we're trying is, will the offsets from a facility or any emitting source sort of be continual? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the question. And certainly the expectation is that they would be and should be. The question of how to make that continual is the question that I think we're trying to struggle with. Short of capture and formal sequestration, there are only the other options that you have to serve, and we want to maximize that flexibility to make sure we do that most effectively and most economically.
Okay. I do have a question. What is this legislation, how will it impact the Big Stone 2 project?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Big Stone 2 facility is a facility that would be affected by this legislation.
How specifically do you? Can you give us some examples on this, how you see it being impacted?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this legislation, these words that we're talking about, are also a policy that Governor Pawlenty has asked me to implement. As a result, I have been in communications with the proposers of the Big Stone 2 and have been discussing with them how to address the carbon emissions that would be emitted from that facility and what kind of offsets and what kinds of approaches that can be taken to address it.
I'm also familiar with there's a Mesaba project. I'm real familiar with, but is that something that will be impacted by this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Mesaba project, which is proposed by the Excelsior Energy operation, has a exemption from the Certificate of Need statute. The statute, the language that you have before you, and you see on page 23, line 11, amends 216B.243. It goes on to amend the subsequent set. Those are all internal to the Certificate of Need, which by previous law adopted in 2003, the Excelsior project is exempt from. However, I've already talked, as I've mentioned, that this is a policy of Governor Pawlenty's, and I have been, again, in communication with them on how they can offset their emissions, too.
Thank you. Is there any other questions from the members? I do believe we have a quorum here now.
Just lay it over.
Okay. We're going to lay this one over. We're going to lay this bill over then. I thank you, Mr. Garvey, for your comments and testimony today. And we're going to hand the gavel back over to Senator Prettner-Solin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
The next bill up is Senate File 192, Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I should probably start by saying we have a delete all amendment, the A3. Delete all, which probably no one has seen. So there's probably the first thing we should do is make sure everyone has a copy of that so they can go through that. We have plenty of copies, I'm sure. And let me start by saying that the delete all does not make, I don't believe it makes changes that are very substantive. It doesn't go, the changes that are in there are minor, I believe, and don't go to the guts of the bill. So just for the members who are all the members of the audience who are watching and listening and have seen the bill, I just want to lay that out there. And we'll go through it, but I just for preparation purposes, I'd like to make sure everybody has it. Okay, Madam Chair.
Okay, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, you want to move the bill first?
Yeah, I'll move the...
I mean, you want to move the amendment
The
first.
Delete all A3 as an author's amendment just okay. to get the bill in the shape I'd like to present it.
So Senator Anderson moves the A3 amendment. Okay, and this is an author's amendment. Just put the bill in the shape that she desires. So all those in favor of the A3 amendment, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
And as I understand it today, I'm just going to explain the purpose of the bill and how it would work generally. And then I have two witnesses with me who can help me answer questions or deal with technical questions people have about the bill. I have with me Drake Hamilton from Fresh Energy and Barbara Fries from the Union of Concerned Scientists. Members, I think it was just 3 weeks ago that we had our historic hearing on the House floor where a number, all of us were there, hopefully, and many other legislators to listen to some preeminent Minnesota scientists and Will Steger about the urgency and the need for us to take action and the danger that we face to maintaining Minnesota's quality of life if we don't act to reduce CO2 emissions in our state and greenhouse gas emissions. We also heard about the harm that could come to our Minnesota quality of life, to our waters and our fish, our wildlife, our forests, and our agricultural industry from global warming if we do not take action. We also heard from our faith leaders who reminded us of our moral responsibility to protect the earth and its living things and of our responsibility, both as individuals and as elected leaders, to take action when we see a threat to our earth and to all the people that live on it, as well as the wild creatures. This is a daunting problem for us to face as a state, as a nation, and as a world. And we know it will take decades to really solve the problem. But at the same time, we know that there's an urgency to act, and that, you know, one thing that I've learned over all my 15 years of working on energy policy is that the energy decisions that are made have repercussions that last for decades, if not longer. We know that there's so many examples of that. And we know that if we're going to make changes, we have to start. We have to set a roadmap and change the direction if we hope to see changes in the next decade and in the next half century to century in the lifetime of our children and grandchildren. And so we think it's urgent for us to address this issue now and to take action and to get started in moving our state in the direction that we think is right for our future. First, we need to set up a path to stabilize our greenhouse gas emissions. Then we need to figure out how to reduce them. We also know that the longer that we wait, the longer that we put action off, as difficult as it may be, the harder it will be to change these things and the more there will be to offset and to eliminate and reduce. The harder it will be to achieve the cuts that we need, the longer that we wait. So the bill does a number of things. It starts with a planning process. And I'm going to talk about the bill in logical order rather than in the order that it has to be drafted. So I'll just point to the sections as I go. The planning process in Senate File 192 is essentially laid out in Section 5. Deputy Commissioner Garvey talked about the fact that the governor has already begun a planning process that brings into our state national experts who can facilitate a planning process. And it will bring together a cross-section of Minnesotans from different sectors of our economy and society. And I know that they're already underway with starting that process and trying to put together the list of stakeholders who will participate in that. I really want to commend the governor for taking leadership on this issue. We tried to pass – the Senate passed a plan 3 years ago, so we also deserve to be commended for our foresight in trying to move this issue forward. And now I think it's great to know that the House will come with us as well, and we'll deal with this issue seriously. This bill builds on the same process that the governor is recommending for planning, with some differences. What we would do that's different is to focus the planning process by setting some specific goals that we want our state to achieve. We want to set some long-term reduction goals, and these are in Section 3 of the bill. So if you look to Section 3, at the bottom of page 2, it's a very short section, but this is very important because it lays out what our state's goals for greenhouse gas reduction targets would be, starting with a level of at least 15% below 2005 emissions by 2015, and at the higher end, getting to 80% reduction from 2005 levels by 2050. Why we want to have goals in place is to have the planning group have something specific to work with as they are studying the issue and figuring out recommendations to bring back to us for how to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We want to tell them, here's where we think we need to be, and they can come back and tell us how that could be done and whether it would be cost-effective, what the costs and benefits would be. We think it's important to put these goals in place now at the beginning of the process so that we can send a signal to those who are making long-term energy investments in Minnesota that we can't just assume that the future will allow unlimited greenhouse gas emissions. And quantifying these goals will help us steer investments starting now in the right direction. But it's important. And the Climate Strategies Group, which the governor is bringing in, has told us that they are comfortable working either with specific goals or without them, so they can work very comfortably with this type of a target in place. They have done this in some other states. And just to tell you the reason for the numbers that we've selected here, there's not really a magic formula except that the 80% below emissions, well, 20, let me explain why we picked 2005, because Senator Prettner-Solon asked me this. And the reason, as I understand it, is this is the most recent data that we have about greenhouse gas emissions is basically based on 2005. And so we're kind of using that as a proxy for current emissions, more or less. It's 2005 levels. And the science tells us that we need to be looking at reducing our greenhouse emissions by 80% by the year 2050. And so that's the long-term goal that we need to have in mind. And we start by setting some more moderate goals that are shorter term. The shortest goal of reducing to 15% below current levels by 2015 is only slightly more aggressive than what the governor is proposing in his bill of reducing the state's fossil fuel per capita use by 15% by 2015. So it's fairly similar to that proposal. And then there's an intermediate goal that would hopefully keep us on that trajectory. It's important, I want to point out, that these targets in Section 3 are not mandatory. These are goals. And they would not become mandatory until we pass further legislation that says we're going to do this and here's how we're going to get there. So that would be something that would happen off in the future after we have our planning process. But this just sets some benchmarks for us to look at in the planning process and to work towards. Okay? Other states, I want to point out that Minnesota would not be by any means alone in setting these kinds of targets or goals for state reductions of greenhouse gas emissions. Many states around the nation have established their own reduction targets. We have a handout, actually, that has a map. Many states around the nation, as you'll see, some, 12 to 15, have already established their own greenhouse gas reduction targets, including two states that announced them, Illinois and New Jersey, just in the last week. We have a handout that's coming around that shows the goals adopted by the states that have acted so far. Minnesota's goal, as stated in Section 3, would not be the most aggressive goal, and it would not be the weakest goal. It would be somewhere in the middle. Okay? So this just gives you an idea that what I'm proposing here in Minnesota is not unique in the nation by any means. Many, many other states are taking this issue very seriously and are already moving ahead. Next, let's see, I'd like to talk about another goal of this bill, and that is for what we call no backsliding. And to me, that sort of goes back to the old saying, if you find yourself in a hole, the first thing you should do is stop digging. And so what we want to do is say that as we're moving forward in making a plan, we don't want things to get worse. We want to at least stay where we are and stabilize the current situation. It will take a year for this plan, whether in my bill or in the governor's bill, to come back to us. And beyond that, it will take who knows how much time, additional time, to implement any recommendations or changes. That would take probably a long period of time to be fully implemented. However, it's very possible that while we have that process of planning and implementation and discussion and debate and public input going on, there could be major new investments made in power plants in Minnesota that would represent major long-term, multi-decade increases in greenhouse gas emissions in our state. For example, if a new coal plant is built in Minnesota, it would emit the same amount of greenhouse gas as roughly 700,000 cars, but it would obviously last a lot longer than a car would. So in order to prevent an increase in long-term pollution from undermining our pollution reduction planning process and increasing the overall cost of reaching these goals, the bill includes two provisions for anti-backsliding. As the governor said recently, we should not make the situation worse while we try to make it better. That was very well said. So the first one is in Section 6, and this is our offset provision, although it's different from the governor's. That's Section 6 of the bill. Section 6 of the bill says, is entitled No Net Increase from New Power Plants. And what it says is that new fossil-fueled power plants are prevented from being built unless they offset their CO2 emissions. Now, we had some discussions about how the governor is proposing doing that, and this bill is much tighter in how it would define what is an acceptable offset. But in the concept, we agree with the governor, who similarly requires new power plants to offset their new emissions. What we disagree with is over what would represent an acceptable offset. We believe it's critical that any pollution reduction projects used to offset a new power plant be absolutely verifiable. There is a global market emerging in credits that claim to offset greenhouse gases. Some of them are high-quality projects, but some are not. Sorting between the good projects and the bad projects, you know, the temporary trees and the long-term projects that really work, the good ones and the bad ones, it can be extremely difficult to sort that out. And before we allow the construction of a new power plant based on an offset, we need to be sure that only a real good offset project would get through the door. So our bill is narrow in its definition, allowing two kinds of offsets. First, a plant could offset its emissions by reducing CO2 emissions from an existing power plant. Section 6 of the bill, page 7.
What section?
Okay, I have to find the exact wording here.
7.24.
All right, if you look on page 7, I think it's 7.24. Yeah, if you look on 7.24, it says, well, paragraph B, a project proponent may offset the new large energy facility's contribution to statewide power sector CO2 emissions in one or a combination of the following ways, paragraph 1 and 2. So one would be by reducing CO2 emissions from an existing facility. Let's see. And in that way, you could avoid increasing our statewide emissions. You could give the example of the Merck project, in which Xcel agreed to voluntarily convert two old coal plants to a natural gas. That would be a conversion or a reduction and an offset. The second way that a new power plant could offset their CO2 emissions would be to buy allowances from states that already have in place a cap-and-trade system for their electricity sector. And that brings me to the second provision, which is the cap and trade proposal. And that you will find in Section 5 of the bill, which starts on page 4. No. Starts on page 5, sorry. The cap and trade is subdivision 3 of Section 5. Starts at the top of page 5.4. The bill would also require the Pollution Control Agency to set up a cap-and-trade system for the CO2 emissions from power plants. Cap-and-trade is a concept that's been around for a long time. It's widely recognized as the most flexible, efficient, and market-friendly way to reduce greenhouse gases. I keep asking the proponents a lot of questions. Why don't we just say, you know, thou shalt not emit any more greenhouse gases to each plant? And what they have convinced me of is the reason that cap and trades have been so desirable as an alternative is that they're just much more efficient and work in the marketplace. Because, say, you have one plant in which it would be cost-effective to really reduce their emissions, and another plant where it wouldn't be, you need to have the flexibility to make those choices depending on market forces and decisions that are better made by a utility so that they can do this in the most flexible way possible.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Sanchin.
Senator Anderson, there may be people around this table, in this audience, and maybe in the TV audience that do not know what cap and trade means. Could you just explain that?
That's a good question. Okay, so basically what it would say is that we will set a limit, which would be at the current level. We would cap CO2 emissions at the current level. So this is the piece that says we're going to stop where we are and not make things worse. And so you wouldn't be able to emit any more CO2 in our state from the electricity sector from what is now defined as 2005 levels, current levels. But you could buy an allowance for emitting CO2, and those are, you can sell or trade those in the marketplace. So let me go through my explanation, and maybe that will help to explain that part a little bit better, and my experts can help too. So basically it caps CO2 emissions and then allows trading in the marketplace of the right to emit carbon dioxide. Cap and trade is the mechanism we've used with great success in Minnesota to reduce acid rain pollution over the last several years. And it was especially successful in Minnesota, and it allowed the nation to meet its pollution reduction goals at a cost far less than anyone anticipated. Building on that success, there are already several states moving forward with cap and trade proposals for their electricity sectors right now, including 9 states in the Northeast and California, which is the best known, and a number of other states are also exploring cap and trade proposals right now. But we know there's already 10 states that have them in place. So rather than put pollution or CO2 limits on each individual facility, a cap and trade proposal will put a cap on the pollution that a large group of facilities can emit. Then the state issues allowances, which are essentially tradable permits. So a permit to emit a certain amount of CO2. Each allowance gives the owner of it, or the bearer of it, the right to emit 1 ton of carbon dioxide, and they can be bought and sold among those who need them. In this way, the marketplace determines where emission reductions can be most cheaply made. Under this bill, the MPCA, the Pollution Control Agency, would auction allowances off to those who need them. The price of the allowances would be set by supply and demand. The money obtained from the allowances would go into a fund to help us achieve emission reduction goals. One of the things the multi-stakeholder planning process would consider is how best to use that fund to try to achieve greater CO2 reductions and move our state towards that path. The cap in this bill is set, as I said, at current or 2005 levels of CO2, roughly current emissions, and the most recent year for which we have data. So unlike the cap-and-trade program in the northeastern states or the one that we expect to happen in California, this cap is just a stable number. It does not go down. It just says, let's stop right where we are. So it's an anti-backsliding provision to prevent increases while we figure out through this planning process how to actually reduce emissions. The planning process may well recommend a schedule for reducing a cap, but this bill just prevents any increases beyond current or 2005 levels. We actually believe...
Anderson.
Yes.
It is 2007, though, and it
I know.
May be 2008 before we get started. So what do they do with the emissions that have increased from 2005? Are there penalties for that, or how is that accounted for?
Go ahead. Please just identify yourself when you start. I'm going to need some help answering that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Barbara Fries with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Our One thing that will happen is that this cap and trade would not go into effect until 2009. So in anticipation of that, we would hope that utilities would look at 2005 emissions and consider if they have had increases in the meantime, they could slide downward toward the 2009. But essentially what would happen is that the cap would be set at the number that represents to our best understanding what current emissions are. So we would not expect there to be a dramatic adjustment when the cap and trade goes into effect, and particularly if it is basically if there are 2 years of notice for the industry before the cap takes
and
effect.
Are there known ways of sliding downward?
There certainly are.
I mean, do they know how they're going to do that?
Well, that's the beauty of a cap-and-trade system is that each utility, each facility can think about different ways that they could do that. And among them, of course, is shifting more toward renewable energy. And the renewable energy standard that you have passed and that we are all hoping will be soon signed will actually be putting them on that path in a pretty aggressive way immediately. And we are also hopeful that if you pass energy efficiency legislation this year, you will also have that reducing their CO2 emissions. So we're already putting in place policies that will help them achieve this cap and make it as painless as possible.
So, Madam Chair, I think you could adjust this so that it reflects 2007 if you had the numbers, if you have the data to do that. This is not an attempt to try to move back. We're trying to reflect current levels.
Okay.
We just don't want to go any higher than current levels. So if there's a way, and part of the bill that I have, and I'll get to in a minute, is a collection of data, a reporting process so that we will get accurate data. But it takes some time to get there, and we just don't want things to get a lot worse in a year or two while we figure that out. So
okay.
That can be adjusted.
Mr. Fuller for a minute.
Madam Chair, members, Ms. Fries, just a general question about the cap and trade system. It's my understanding you need an allowance to emit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so if you are a power plant, let's say you are emitting 1,000 units or whatever, and currently, are you given 1,000 units then, or do you have to buy those units?
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller,
Ms.
under our bill, you would have to buy those units. There are some cap-and-trade proposals that give them away. This bill would auction them. And the reason why is that you are essentially auctioning off, if you will, the right to use the atmosphere to dispose of these industrial gases. That atmosphere belongs to the public, and to auction the right and then take that funding and put it into a public fund for the benefit of the public seems like the most appropriate way to handle it.
Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Ms. Fries, so if you had 1,000 units and you went down to 900 and you paid for that reduction, you would then also have to pay for the 900 that was remaining. And so what impact would that have on the economics of that power plant?
Ms. Fries.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, I want to make sure I understand your question. You would have to look at all of the tons you plan to emit, and you would look at the market price of an allowance, which would be set by the auction and other sales that could occur subsequently. And then each facility would decide, is it cheaper to reduce or cheaper to buy the allowances? And they would then make that decision based on what flexibility they have and what the price is. Now, again, because we have already implemented the RES, and I'm assuming, of course, it's going to be enacted into law, and if we adopt the energy efficiency, they will already be moving. Demand will already be moving down below current levels. And what that means is, since the cap essentially establishes the supply, the demand would be moving downward, and therefore we believe that the price of the allowances would be quite nominal.
Mr. Fuller.
Just two more questions. Can non-emitters buy allowances? I mean, is there a market where people could play the market in that sense and bid up the cost of these credits? Who's allowed to buy the allowances?
That would be something, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, that would be something that the MPCA could determine in its rulemaking.
And then the last question
Mr.
would be, if you had a plant that emitted and it had its cost of operations and it charged rates to its customers, and then it invested in reducing pollution, which would be a cost. Then it would also have a cost of buying the allowances added onto its operating cost. Is that correct? And I assume they could recover that through their rates. So there'd be three sets of costs: their costs that they had before this came in, then the cost of whatever reduction they did, and then the cost of buying the credits to allow them to emit their remaining emissions. Is that correct?
Ms. Freeze.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, that is correct. Those would be considered environmental compliance costs, and they would be passed through like current environmental compliance costs are today. One thing I should point out is that the utilities that we're talking about regulating are already subject to cap and trade under the Federal Clean Air Act. They do this all the time with respect to SO2. They will be doing it very soon with respect to mercury. So this is not something that they are unfamiliar with, nor something that the PUC is unfamiliar with. And these are costs, along with other sorts of environmental compliance costs, that could be passed on to ratepayers.
Okay.
The final question.
I have another question. Mr. Fuller.
This is almost a rhetorical question. Do you have any notion of what that cost would be?
Ms. Freeze.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller, I've referred you to the RES and the Energy Efficiency Bill, and I want to point that out again.
This is, Madam Chair, I'm sorry. This is the handout we were just going to hand Anderson. Out that reflects that statement that Ms. Freeze has been making, that we believe that with the passage of the Renewable Energy Standard, which is on the way to the governor's desk, and the energy efficiency legislation this session that Senator Dibble and the governor's office are proposing, if we pass both of those pieces of legislation, then you can see from this chart that that will get our utilities in Minnesota below 2005 levels. And so they would already meet the requirement, we believe, if we pass those two pieces. We still have one more to work on.
Okay, Senator Anderson, you want to continue?
Sure. Okay, and so because of that, because we think that if we pass both of these pieces of legislation, that they will already meet the requirements of this cap and trade system, that there would be as Ms. Freeze said, it would be a nominal cost. It wouldn't really be, I don't know exactly how to characterize that, but it would be nominal. And very low. Other states. This bill requires the MPCA to try to integrate the market that it will be creating for CO2 allowances with those markets springing up in other states and to consult with other Midwestern states about joining our market. To me, this is really important because I would love to see us have some kind of a regional cap and trade system rather than it just being Minnesota. I think ultimately that would be really successful for us as a region, but the governor is really the one who's in a position to make that happen, to negotiate with other governors and try to get a compact or some kind of agreement across the Midwest. We're not governors, we're legislators, so what we can do is at least try to encourage that to happen. And so we have language that's basically the same or very similar to what the governor's bill has in it, to consult with other Midwestern states to try to ask them to join our market. And I'm trying to make those contacts with individual legislators from other states. As a state with tremendous renewable resources here and no fossil fuels of our own, Minnesota is in a position to really benefit greatly economically from being in a multi-state CO2 market because we're the ones that can export. We have the ability to provide the allowances that many other states will need. So I believe a regional CO2 plan will most likely be effective as a bridge, if we can get to that, before there's a national law. The bill in Section 4 has a reporting requirement, so I'd like to just mention that. And that is page top of page 3, that starts, Section 4. And all I need to say about that, I believe, is that if we're to implement the recommendations of this multi-stakeholder process and track our progress towards meeting our goals, we need to know who is emitting what. And that's what this reporting system would do, is to collect data from emitters of greenhouse gas emissions, so we could have a baseline of information. Section 7 of the bill, finally, is a resource planning requirement that says that that would ensure that the financial impact of future carbon regulations, especially those that we expect to have nationally in the future, we want to make sure that those future costs of carbon regulation are factored into decisions made by utilities now. To assume that greenhouse gases will be allowed to be emitted for free in the future is a financially reckless assumption. We want to make sure our power sector is realistic about the financial risks inherent in increasing our pollution at a time like this, so that they can take steps that will reduce that risk. And on that point, maybe I'll just talk for a moment about a question that I expect to hear, which is, why not wait? Why not wait for a federal law? Because I do believe that a federal law is inevitable, a federal law limiting CO2 emissions. And I have a little chart here of all the different cap-and-trade greenhouse gas proposals currently in Congress. There's a number of them. And we know that McCain-Lieberman is the best known, and that came close to passing the Senate a few years ago in the last term of Congress. I believe a resolution has actually passed the U.S. Senate that says that the Congress needs to adopt this type of policy. So it's not quite there yet, but I think it's only a matter of time. And I think if you ask just about anybody who pays attention to these issues, they will agree that federal regulation of CO2 emissions is absolutely inevitable. It's just a matter not of if, but of when. And so it could be 5 or 10 years away. And our concern is that if we wait, we will be disadvantaged, because we will have the risk for our ratepayers of incurring tremendous higher costs if we go ahead and increase our greenhouse gas emissions between now and then. So what this bill will do, as I said, is stop us where we are and allow us to be prepared for this new regime of carbon restrictions. We also know that when it comes to environmental technology, that the governments and the industries that are the early adopters are the ones that tend to be the most successful, because they can create that technology and be the national, if not the world, leaders in carbon reduction strategies and technologies. And, you know, Minnesota has the know-how as well as the renewable resources to be leaders in this area. So I believe that if we act now and start going down this path, we will be better protected, and our ratepayers will be better protected than if we wait to have Washington tell us we have to do it. Sure. We have a side-by-side. This is the last handout, and I think I'm ready to wrap up my comments. A side-by-side that's basically a comparison of the governor's bill and our bill, and I think there's another one that's been done by counsel or research. So if we act now, it will prevent us from making some very costly mistakes in the next decade that our ratepayers will be paying the price for decades after CO2 regulations become enacted across the country. So I'll stop with that, Madam Chair, and see if there's questions.
Yes, Senator Anderson, I think I heard two things. One of them was that there was a study that was, or that how to measure carbon emissions would be studied and determined, but then also that the industry already knew how to reduce their carbon and how to measure it, because they're already under a cap-and-trade system for a number of things.
I think they're under a cap-and-trade for other sorts of chemicals, but not for carbon dioxide. So can one of you answer that?
Chair, please.
With respect to carbon dioxide from power plants, that is not a particularly difficult thing to measure. There are ways you can do it either through direct monitoring, or you can simply calculate what the emissions would be based on the fuel that goes into the plant and the heat rate from the plant. There are, in fact, estimates made for the EPA right now, and the PCA is also collecting some of this data, I know. So the actual effort of determining how much CO2 comes out of a power plant, that should not be particularly difficult and really doesn't need to slow us down very much.
And can you separate that from renewable energy?
Separate?
For each separate utility, can you separate how much renewable energy they're using as opposed to how much non-renewable energy they're emitting?
You could determine it based on a facility, on a plant-by-plant basis. So you would count up the CO2 from each of your coal plants and from each of your natural gas plants. You could also count up the CO2 that you are importing from out of state if you know what plant it's coming from, and most of the time you would. So you would also find out what the CO2 emission rates are from those plants. There may be a bit of a judgment call with respect to purchases of power on the market, on the spot markets, where you might not know precisely what plant they're coming, that power is coming from. We have there's language in this bill that would give the MPCA the authority to estimate. If they can't actually track the power back to a particular facility, they would have the ability to estimate what the CO2 values would be for that kind of power. And of course, this does not need to be done on a real-time basis. This is something they could do over a period of time where they would say, okay, here's how many megawatt hours we obtained from these different sources, and move forward from there. But of course, the actual details of calculation and tracking are the sorts of things that the MPCA would put forward.
Can you point to where in the bill it shows that the MPCA will be making that determination?
Sure. There is a provision on page 6. It's subdivision 5, line 6.23, determining emissions of imported power. And that's the provision where we discuss how they would, if they know where the power is coming from, then they could use either actual emission monitoring, or they could use emission factors or any other method that they think is appropriate. But the one thing to keep in mind is that there are not that many sources, and they're very large, and they already have to track all kinds of information about the fuel that they consume, for example. So, and they're already reporting this information in some fashion to the EPA. I mean, there are reports that you can find on the CO2 emissions of every utility in the nation. So this is not information that we haven't been trying to collect already in the past.
Does it say Minnesota Pollution Control Agency in the bill?
I
see reference to commissioner, but I don't see a definition of commissioner.
Well, Madam Chair, if you look at the beginning of Section 5, which I think this is part of, it refers to the it says the commissioners of the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Commerce for the plan. And then in Subdivision 3, it says that under the cap and trade, the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. So I think you're right that that's ambiguous, and so it should say PCA commissioner on 6.25, correct?
That would
intention.
Be right. That's certainly the intention, and that would all flow from the MPCA's rulemaking.
Thank you for noticing that.
Thank you.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Anderson, I came in a little late, so maybe you talked about this already. Those darn constituents, you know, they always want our ears, and so I apologize for being late. You know, many times we talk about different things on science. We come from different ends of science, so I've been studying the CO2 and the global warming science for the last month and a half. But I don't think it's really applicable today, because now I got my free market hat on. And I'm kind of thinking in terms of this bill, if it creates opportunities to basically, I guess, carbon sink farm, And what got me thinking about that is I personally live on a little 5.5-acre patch, and I planted all this nice trees and prairie grasses and stuff to create my own little biosphere. But would this allow opportunities for somebody like myself or somebody to literally go out and use the science, say, of Dr. Tillman's science to show what the prairie grasses will sink for carbon and then sell those on the cap and trade?
We don't, Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, I don't believe, I always try to say it the wrong way, or the German way, or whatever way it is.
It's okay, I accept it anyway.
I don't believe we make an accommodation for that specifically in this bill. Do you want to add to that, Jay?
Madam Chair, yes, my name is Jay Drake Hamilton with Fresh Energy, and Senator Jungbauer, members of the committee. I think that would be up to the Pollution Control Agency as they set the parameters for the cap and trade system. I think to be consistent with this bill language, it would need to be real and verifiable and permanent and additional. So if you were doing it as something extra, yes, probably the answer would turn out to be, especially if it were on a large scale, that this is likely to be something that that kind of system would recognize and reward.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Anderson, I guess as we move ahead on some of these kind of things, that's what I look for is, rather than look at the issues that kind of separate us, is how can we work together on these kind of issues so that there is something for everyone, if you will, in creating a new way to make some money for some people, maybe in areas that otherwise, whether it's agricultural or otherwise. So I guess I'd be interested in pursuing that kind of a discussion behind the scenes, I guess, to work some of those details out, because I think that way you could get more of the stakeholder buy-in, if you will, if we knew that there was some other options there that we had a choice to try to create.
And Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer,
Anderson.
I think that is a very good suggestion, because we're all getting we're hearing so much information about those opportunities and those possibilities, and that does add more flexibility. We talked about that more in the context of the offsets language before you got here, but in the context of the cap and trade, I think you're absolutely right. It makes really good sense to look at that and to figure out how we could measure whether those really work, whether they're really sequestering CO2. And so I'd be glad to work with you on trying to improve that in the bill.
Thank you.
Other questions or comments? Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, is it possible for a company to trade these within their own company? If they had a plant that was a modern, efficient plant, not
allowances are company-wide, aren't they? I mean, Madam Chair, I think
Senator Anderson.
I think the allowances would be to the company rather than to the plant.
Oh, okay.
So that's exactly why they could be flexible. So they would have an allowance for their overall portfolio. So, you know, for XL, they'd have an allowance, then they have, you know, a big coal plant, a lot of wind, some hydro, and they could sort of figure out how overall they could make it work to reach, you know, to reach the desired amount of CO2 that they want to emit based on the cost of buying an allowance or reducing emissions. Does that make sense?
Senator Anderson, when you talk about an allowance, though, it's something that they have to buy. So,
well, Madam Chair, that's the way we have it set up. I already wrote that down. That, you know, it's if we're going to, I think ultimately, yes, it absolutely has to be. It has to have a market value to it. When we're starting out here at the sort of the baseline, that's something we could probably talk about. But I think, to make this system work, you have to put a value on CO2. That's the point of being able to trade them, is that there's some value to them, so that those who want to emit more are willing to pay for them. And those who want to or are able to emit less are able to sell them. And so the marketplace has to work. And so they have to have, that's why they have value. I mean, basically what we're doing here, as I understand it, is trying to incorporate the real cost of CO2 emissions into the cost of our energy, which it's not included in now. There's not a cost applied to the cost of energy that relates to CO2. And this would put that cost into the energy, but it could be moved around. So you have an incentive to reduce it. Am I wrong?
It's really hard to grasp. But
yes,
and you're saying that there already is cap and trade in place for mercury emissions and sulfur dioxide, and those are nationwide, is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Ms. Hamilton.
There is the market, the cap and trade system for mercury will be emerging as a result of the law that was passed last year. But for a long time now, there has been trading in the acid rain program of the Clean Air Act. So we have long experience with that. If I would just add, I think what this bill tries to do is to create a market and then to allow free market forces, hopefully very beneficial to entities in Minnesota, to get the clean and low-carbon technologies into the marketplace, make money, and sell those to other states and other regions and other countries. But right now, the scientists are saying we're seeing damages. The economists are saying we're seeing risks and damages, but we have no market factor, no market mechanism to allow people to make money and create their own opportunities. And so this tries to do that. I would also note that this bill mirrors what the direction that the state of New York and the state of Massachusetts are deciding to go in that they are auctioning off allowances. So what they're saying is if you're in a carbon market, you establish a price, and then the market forces will drive that price down. So both New York and Massachusetts are moving in the direction that this bill would lay out.
Now, California passed a law, too. Do they have a cap-and-trade system in place also?
Yes. Their Public Utilities Commission, Madam Chair, is setting up a cap-and-trade system. And they're also looking at working with Oregon and Washington and with the New England states, because generally bigger for a marketplace is better in terms of being able to drive down prices.
Madam Chair, we had an opportunity to bring in one of Governor Schwarzenegger's senior staff people to talk about their program. And I don't believe he's available for, another few weeks?
He's scheduled to come into town. He's Terry Tamminen. He's Governor Schwarzenegger's advisor on energy and environmental issues. And he's scheduled to come to Minnesota on March 21 and 22.
So we'd love to bring him to the committee. It may be a little late for our deadline. Well, it may not be.
Might still be helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you. I did step out of the room, so if we've covered this, we can talk later. But I'm glad you raised the subject of Governor Schwarzenegger, I think I see in here where we'll get to other sectors. Did we talk about other sectors and their contributions to CO2 and how we get to that? And we haven't.
We have not.
All right. So one of the differences, of course, with AB 32, or one of the hallmarks of AB 32 is, I think the plan that's mandated. Via that. It's not called out specifically in the bill because I actually read it because I'm that kind of guy. But clearly one of the outcomes is that this organization or this committee that's convened, is charged with creating some identifying all the sources of carbon dioxide, all the sectors, not just the electrical utility generation sector. Transportation goes on, the list goes on, and trying to find some ways of reducing carbon dioxide emissions from those sectors. So, Madam Chair and Senator Ansh, and this is, of course, is one of the issues that was articulated when we passed the RES off the Senate floor. So, what are your thoughts, or how do you respond to those ideas?
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, that's an extremely important point, and I think it is. Important to say that, as you did, that the whole burden of solving this problem cannot fall on the electricity sector alone. And there's so much of it, especially in the transportation side, that relates to personal responsibility. And so we're talking about a broad, huge problem-solving job that we have ahead of us to try to help Minnesotans come to the conclusions of how they can make some changes. But the targets that are in this bill are statewide. As I said, they're not mandatory. They're targets. They're goals. And what will happen in this planning process is that they will be looking at those statewide goals. So we would expect that the planning process would come back with reduction strategies across all sectors. And I think there's one other piece in this bill that, do you want to talk about the MPCA authority?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
Let me just ask Senator Anderson, okay. If these are goals and they're not mandatory, then what is the purpose of the cap and trade system?
Okay, the purpose of the cap and trade is to stabilize emissions right where they are, not to reduce emissions. So the cap and trade would be it's required, but it would stabilize emissions. It does not reduce emissions. It just says we're going to stop right where we are. And the goals set up some goals for where we need to be eventually, and they are intended to inform this planning process that's going to take a period of time, and then the plan will come back, and then the legislature will have to debate it, and, you know, we'll have to implement some laws and do whatever else we can to try to get to those goals. In the meantime, the cap-and-trade system will make sure that we don't make the problem worse while we're going through that longer planning process. It's basically a cap on current greenhouse gas emissions. That's what the cap is on the electricity side.
So is there a rigid rule in here at this point that our emissions need to meet? And are there penalties if they are not met? Or is it all voluntary?
Well, the goals are neither voluntary nor, I mean, they're not, they're just goals that the legislature would express as where we want to be. The cap is mandatory, and it doesn't have penalties. It just says you have to stop. You can't emit any more CO2 than you do right now. And the allowances are what help to make that work, because there's financial cost to emitting more CO2. If you want to add to your emissions, you'd have to buy some allowances to do that under a cap-and-trade system.
But who's going to enforce it? Why would anybody buy it if it's...
And that's enforceable by the Pollution Control Agency, that whole system of the cap-and-trades.
Madam Chair, if I could...
It's much better enforcement.
Just chime in on that. I do want to make a distinction between the cap that is established on CO2 emissions in the cap and trade section, that is at 2005 or as close as we can come to current levels, and the emission reduction targets, which are the 2015, 25, and 50 targets. The 2015, 25, and 50 targets are intended to send a signal to those who are making long-term investments now and to guide the planning process, but there is no policy mechanism that this law would launch that would achieve those targets. And so in that sense, we can't say they're mandatory. And in that sense, that makes them different than what California has already done and what the state of New Jersey has a bill right now in place that they're considering. So in those states, they are either doing or planning to actually achieve those goals, allowing a state agency, or rather requiring a state agency, to put in place the policy mechanisms it takes to arrive at those reduction targets. In our case, we're putting them in place to have the stakeholder planning process identify those targets, or rather identify those policies, and bring them back to you next year. But the cap and trade cap, the 2005 do not get worse cap, that would be a legally enforceable cap, legally enforceable by the MPCA using its enforcement authorities.
So, and Mr. Fuller is now informing me that there are both criminal and civil penalties involved?
There would be the standard MPCA enforcement authorities. I actually was an attorney for the MPCA for over a dozen years, and criminal enforcement was not something that I saw once. And so it would be the only the sort of thing that if you were in a situation of very intentional violations that you might ever see something like that.
So, Madam Chair, basically Section 8 is the enforceability. I think that's what you're referring to, and that refers to the law that the MPCA uses to enforce its laws.
I'm going to ask Mr. Fuller to point out the enforcement provisions.
Madam Chair, members, there are three of them on page 3.33, which relates to the greenhouse gas reporting system. You'll see that sections 115.071 and 115.075 apply to rules adopted under section. Those are enforcement sections. They'll provide for the ability to impose criminal misdemeanor penalties, civil penalties, injunctions, administrative penalties, specific performance, and 115, that's 115.071. 115.075 applies to false information and then tampering with metering devices. you'll see again on page 6, line 17, which relates to, among other things, the cap and trade system, the same set of enforcement mechanisms. And you'll see on page 8, line 12, which is called enforceability, it refers to Chapter 116B, which is the Environmental Rights Act, which provides to private citizens the ability to bring a lawsuit to get an injunction, for instance, to shut down a power plant. It's a violation of that section. So the Environmental Rights Act is a very broad toolbox for private citizens and others.
So, Madam Chair, I think it basically it's referencing laws that are commonly available to enforce environmental regulations.
Okay. Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think part of what you were getting to clarify, so Senator Anderson, is we're trying to stop dead in our tracks, and the reporting system would verify the baseline today, and any cap and trade would be done on new emissions beyond today's level based on this reporting system. Is that?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, I think the reason we set current at 2005 levels because we already have that data. But we could, you know, we can talk about whether it makes more sense to do it at 2007 levels if we can get that data. But the basic idea is, yes, stop it at current levels. And then the reporting would bring us information for the planning process for the future, for looking at future strategies, I think.
Senator Jungbar.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, the enforcement done by the PCA, is this the one and the same PCA that I haven't been able to get to enforce any of the Clean Water Act or any of the septic or wastewater rules since 1992 that I've been chasing after them?
It's a different PCA.
Or is this a different PCA that we expect to do something, actually?
I take that as a rhetorical.
Yes, Madam Chair, that was rhetorical.
Senator Sharon.
Just to add, thank you, Madam Chair, just to add to the confusion, because sometimes I think I'm clear and then I lose it again. When you're talking about these levels, whatever that level is, 2005, 2007, whatever it is, that it's statewide, mm-hmm. that keeps us even. We aren't going to create any more. You're talking about if somebody falls below that, that's the way I think of it rather than above it. If somebody is not meeting that target because they, for some reason, have a change in their system that's emitting more CO2 than that standard, that's where you have a regulatory process that comes into play in this bill.
Well, I think they'd
Senator
have to.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, I think they'd have to buy an allowance. It would be like a permit, like any plant that has to get a permit, which is a certain rule that says here's how much pollution you can emit.
To get them back here, they have to buy an allowance, sort of like the renewable energy purchase they can do to meet that standard, something that they can purchase to meet that standard. And where they're going to get that allowance from somebody who Who's got the allowance to sell?
Ms. Freese.
Thank you. Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, a couple of things just to clarify. If one thing I do want to make clear is that under our bill, they would have to buy an allowance for all of their emissions, not just new emissions or increased emissions. They would have to buy an allowance for all of their emissions. But that allowance would be set by market prices that, and in the circumstances where we see demand going down, we think that would be very inexpensive. But the beauty of a cap and trade is, in contrast to a limit placed on every facility, is if your facility has to emit more because you've had some sort of mechanical problem or you didn't plan properly, you can go to the marketplace and buy additional allowances. If you had a legally enforceable limit placed on your facility alone, and you had yourself in that situation, you would be in violation of the law, and there would be an enforcement action taken against you. Or you simply wouldn't be able to emit more than your permit requires, and you might have to find another more expensive means of meeting your energy or otherwise solving your problem. So that's the sort of thing that a cap and trade is particularly good at, because you are in a situation where if you cannot keep your emissions at the level that they need to be at legally. Let's say they have to go up because, of course, this cap is not at this point going down. You have a market to turn to, and essentially what you are doing is paying someone else to reduce their emissions who can do it more cheaply than you can. And that's precisely the sort of market flexibility that makes cap and trade such a popular mechanism for addressing this kind of pollution.
Ms. Freeze, won't it be the case, though, that if we're one of the first states that are stepping out there, that there won't be much to trade?
Madam Chair, actually, Minnesota will be in a very good position to trade. First, there are the other states in the Northeast stepping forward. They are going to be reducing their emissions under their cap. Our emissions are not going to be going down under our cap, at least as this bill requires it. Next year, you may be asked by the stakeholder process to produce it. And also, of course, California is going forward. We don't yet have the details on their plan because it's a rulemaking. But one thing that Minnesota has that most of these other states don't have is a tremendous renewable resource and a renewable energy standard, and again, we hope an efficiency standard. So that means that we can actually imagine Minnesota's CO2 emissions going down below the cap, and that's the chart that's been passed out. Now, if we reduce the cap, then we can't sell those, and that will be something that will be considered by the stakeholder process. But to the extent that the cap stays where it is, or to the extent that we can be more aggressive in our reductions because other states don't have our resources and don't have our other progressive policies with respect to energy, we will have something to sell, and it could be very valuable.
So do you have anything more,
no.
Senator Anderson? Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could just return to my earlier question about where we – I didn't get quite clear myself, and, I want the viewing audience to also be clear. If I understand correctly, the way we might get to the other sectors, the transportation sector, and let me say part of that, just in response to your earlier comment, is – certainly personal responsibility. Part of that, too, is overall transportation policy, land use policy, those sorts of things. Do we get to those through the planning process that involves achieving these reductions, the 15%, the 30%, the 80%? That's not exclusive to the electrical utility generation sector. That's
everything.
Okay.
Excuse me, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Dibble. That's statewide everything. So that's exactly correct, the way you stated it.
But, Senator Anderson, we don't have a plan for a reduction in those emissions anywhere except in the power companies. Is that correct?
Madam Chair.
Ms. Hamilton.
That would be the goal of the year-long stakeholder process, hopefully, in my opinion, guided by a set of targets and timetables coming out of the legislature, that the year-long process would come back and report to the legislature, here are the most cost-effective ways to achieve reductions across the economy of Minnesota. And if Minnesota is like every other state that has gone through this process, economy-wide cap and trade would be one of the top recommendations of the stakeholder group.
Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In regards to what Senator Dibble was saying, do we currently know about what percentage these different sectors are contributing to our current levels? Do we have so we know how kind of where we have to focus our attentions?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, members of the committee, I think we do have a very good idea. I think that the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency has been tracking emissions as best they can for several years now, and perhaps you'll have testimony on Thursday about the actual breakdown. I've seen the breakdown, and it's pretty consistent with other states, very generally one-third to 40% coming from the electric utilities industry sector, very generally about a third coming from the transportation sector. So that includes personal vehicles, but also planes and trains and freight, and then a third coming from other activities. But I know that the Pollution Control Agency has a better breakdown than that.
Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else?
Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Senator Sanders.
Are we suggesting this bill would also cover transportation or not? Or, you know.
Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum, it has goals that are set for reductions that would cover transportation. But as I said, they're not mandatory. They're goals that we would want the planning process, the stakeholders, to look to when they come go through their planning process. And they'd have to come back with recommendations about how it would affect the transportation sector. We have no recommendations about that in this bill or any mandates about that in this bill.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson. Would it home heating, anything would be on the table with respect to the 80% goal?
Madam Chair, I think anything that emits greenhouse gases would be on the table. But again, that's for the stakeholder process. We're really putting a lot of faith into that process to look at this comprehensively, mm-hmm. look at all these sources of greenhouse gas emissions and come back to us with, tell us what are some ways to grapple with that. And I'm sure they'll probably be looking at the whole range of ideas to bring back to us with some recommendations.
Senator Senjum, I asked the same question. I was told everything except my breathing.
Madam Chair, and I don't mean to be facetious with this question, but you know, as we move away from burning things to create energy, and of course the burning process is part and parcel of the CO2 emission, will this drive us or tend to drive us more towards re-looking at nuclear power?
Madam Chair, Senator Senjum,
Senator Anderson,
it's certainly possible that that will be proposed. I mean, I don't know that we want to get into a debate about the costs of nuclear power, the nuclear waste. I mean, there's some major downsides to that, the risks, but it certainly doesn't have CO2 emissions. That's one of the benefits. So I have no doubt that will be, I don't know if the stakeholder process will look at that or not, but I'm sure that there will be people proposing that. I'm not saying that I'll agree with it, but.
Okay. At this time, I think Senator Sparks has a bill that he hasn't introduced. He wants to tell us about it in concept at this time. And so I'll give him a few minutes to explain that so we know what else might be on the table.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, since we're just talking about some of these ideas today, this is a Senator Tomasoni bill. I think he's in the room. If he'd like to come forward and discuss the bill a little bit, if that would be all right with you, Madam Chair.
You both want to go to the table, you may do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging me. I thought as long as we were doing cap and trade and global warming, and you were discussing in this committee hearing, it might be apropos to talk about the bill that I'm going to introduce. I was glad to hear Senator Anderson had a delete all amendment because the bill you're going to be getting in front of you will be changed before it's introduced, so it won't be exactly the same as what you're seeing here. And so don't take it literally, but I'm going to give you the idea here. I think Senator Senjum asked a really good question at the start of the hearing, what is cap and trade? And I think Senator Sharon, at the end of the hearing, asked exactly how does it work. And I think that's part of the problem is that we don't understand it yet, and we don't know if it's going to work that well. And I don't know if any of you listened to me when I spoke on the Senate floor when we talked about the renewable energy standard, but what I said was going forward from here, we should make sure that we don't be in a hurry to do things and that we get them right. And so the bill that I'll be introducing is aimed at getting Minnesota prepared for limits imposed by Congress on greenhouse gas emissions. And to do this, we need to look at every sector of our economy and figure out what we're emitting and then look at every opportunity in our economy to reduce emissions. Right now, we don't know what we're dealing with, and I'm concerned about prescribing solutions before we've diagnosed the problems and opportunities to address the problems. The issue is simply too big for the legislature to delegate to the state agencies with a directive to cap and trade. It is also too big to try and deal with by working with only one sector of the economy. And I keep hearing about cap and trade programs adopted by California and the northeastern states, but those were passed after years of study and thought about how to avoid unintended consequences, which is a huge challenge for any state to try to address the global problem. But we may be a bit easier if we live in a state or a region that is one of the world's largest economies, such as California. Now, even in California and in the northeastern states, after all the study, there's a lot of commentary about the fact that their global warming bills may just move greenhouse gas emissions to neighboring states or to other parts of the world because global warming is a global problem. So in Minnesota, this is very likely to happen because we have a very limited ability to regulate plants and industries that are just over state lines or in neighboring states that are not capping greenhouse emissions. And so it would seem to me that it would be very prudent for us to wait and see how these cap-and-trade programs are going to be working in California and the northeastern states and whether or not they actually do work before we actually set some kind of a standard for us to maintain, because Minnesota, after all, is a dot in the whole equation of CO2 emissions, and while we need to do our part, I think we need to get it right and not rush into it. My main concern with any proposal to cut greenhouse gas emissions is that in order to meet the limits, we either have to develop technologies to cut greenhouse gas emissions or we have to shrink our economy to fit the cap. And I hope whatever actions we take are aimed at the technology approach. I mean, when you hear words like we imagine that this will happen, that means that we really don't know. And if I understand a little bit about what I heard here today about cap and trade, someone has to physically reduce some emissions in order to create an allowance. And that could potentially mean that these allowances are very, very expensive, because the way the marketplace works, unless there's a real lot of allowances, the cost is going to be very, very high. And so are we doing a favor for our ratepayers by going in this direction? Are we doing a favor for our utility companies? Can the CO2 issue can't be solved in Minnesota? And so the problem is, if there's not enough allowances to go around, will they become more and more expensive? How do we know the cost will be nominal? Is the demand for power really moving down, or is the demand moving up? It appears to me that we're at a point where the cap and trade is not very well understood, and that we don't need to move forward quickly on it. But I do think that by inventorying our emissions and finding out exactly what's going on is a good way to start this, because at some point in time we do have to address the problem, but we should address it correctly, I think. So some of the provisions in the bill would be similar to this. It would require that all major sources of greenhouse gas emissions from all sectors of the economy report their greenhouse gas emissions. Large emitters are defined as sources that emit or contribute 10,000 tons per year or more, and they're covered. And this will give us a baseline to look at all the various bills pending in Congress and their effect on the Minnesota economy. And they require actual monitoring and reporting of greenhouse gas emissions by large emitters going forward. They require the PCA to conduct a comprehensive review with public input and with help from national experts of all the factors that are relevant to the cost of Minnesota of various possible federal limits, and looking at sources of greenhouse gas emissions and all the available means to reduce, will report back to the governor and legislature. And this is critical information that is lacking in the debate today. And there's several other provisions in the draft sheet that you have that I'm not sure are going to be in the actual bill that I introduced, but my message, I think, here is that there's a couple of ways to approach this, and Senator Anderson's way is one way, and this is another way. So I just wanted to make sure we got it out.
I'm not sure I heard you say anything other than that we should count our greenhouse emissions and report them to Congress, though.
Oh, no, I said we should. We want to get an inventory of them so we know where they are, where they're coming from, and so then that we can know how to deal with them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Senator Tomassoni, the part where you talk about phasing out and decommissioning all the coal plants in Minnesota, is that part, you're not sure if that will be in the next version? Or?
Well, Senator Anderson, that part, it seems to me, if you actually are serious about reducing CO2, then you want to do something about the very serious emitters, and some of those coal plants are extremely old, and are getting older, and I don't know if they have the ability to reduce the CO2. So unless they actually take steps to reduce the CO2, there probably should be some kind of action taken. Now, whether or not it's phasing them out or figuring another way to do it, or introducing new technology that would work better, is I think some part of the equation that we have to look at.
It seems that by previous bills, though, that everybody would be held at the same standard. Is that that those greenhouse emissions would have to be reduced at every power plant.
Well, but that's considering that they find allowances to purchase, and I think the key here is are these allowances going to be cheap as was insinuated earlier, or are they going to be expensive, and what is the actual outcome to the ratepayers, and what is the actual outcome to our power grid? And so I'm concerned that if we rush into this, that we might not have good information, and I would just like to get good information or to know exactly how it goes forward.
I'm not going to speak entirely for Senator Anderson, but I don't think that cap and trade was the only way to reduce emissions.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Tomassoni, you said something that I agree with, that you shouldn't prescribe the solutions up front until we have all the information. And I think that's the approach that we're taking with the stakeholder process, is to get as much input and different ideas and buy-in to these difficult decisions that will need to be made. I'm not sure that, proposing phasing out plants is a good way to approach that process. I wouldn't go that far personally.
Well, Senator Anderson, that might not be a good
Senator
idea,
Tomassoni.
But it's something that I thought we might want to take a look at. I think getting the stakeholders together and talking about it is very important, and I'm glad you're going to do that. I'm hoping that we don't have one meeting and then say this is the answer and here's the bill and then this is what we're going to end up doing, because I think this is a really, really big issue that we don't have enough information about to be enacting legislation that everybody has to adhere to for the rest of our lives or whatever, to the next legislative session or whatever it might be, or that somebody suddenly comes back after 2 or 3 years and says, this is all wrong. We gotta change it all because it didn't work the first time. So I'm trying to get, in other words, I'm trying to cooperate with you, actually, Senator Anderson, but I'm trying to do it in a little slower way than what you want to do it. That's all.
Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I think this is a little faster than what I have in mind. I'm not proposing closing coal plants, and I don't know that that's something that would be suggested by a stakeholder group. I think we're talking about stopping new emissions from coal plants and from all other sources. In the electricity sector. We just want to stay where we are and work from there. So that's a good starting point. Madam Chair, I wonder, Senator Tomassoni, do you want to speak to Section 5 about the carbon dioxide pipelines or the hydroelectric purchases? Those are kind of...
Those could be in other bills, but they were ideas that were coming through. And that's in reference to being able to capture CO2 from plants such as the IGC plant that could go forward. And I think, you know, when you look at that kind of stuff, you say this is technology that we could put online that will actually help clean up the old technology and will give us a handle on some of the new technology that's there that's two-thirds to three-fourths cleaner than what's going on right now with the ability to sequester. So those are some ideas that are in that I think we should actually talk about, whether or not they would be in the actual bill that I submit. I haven't decided yet.
Okay. Mr. Dibble?
Thanks. I had the same couple of questions about the pipeline, but also I was curious about the hydroelectric. I don't know if you're prepared to talk about that now. I was just curious what problem that's seeking to solve. I'm not familiar with this issue.
I think it's got something to do with who controls the power that comes from Canada, and I don't think it's available to everybody. I think it's only available to one purchaser, so I think it has something to do with that.
Thank you.
And that might be inaccurate, but I think that's what it is.
Right. Thank you.
Senator Alcine.
Madam Chair, Senator Tomassoni, so on the last page under appropriations.
That's one of those things I'm considering whether or not to have it in there or not, but that would be something that we would do probably later on if we were to do the pipeline.
Would that fall into kind of the big picture of this? Would be, we're hearing about a possible maybe one or two steel mills that would be able to be built in northern Minnesota, and this
it would be more of the electrical plant, the IGCC plant that we're talking about building that has the ability to sequester CO2.
Just for the record, the hydroelectric from Canada is not just available to one party.
Okay. Maybe I misunderstood it. But.
Any other questions or comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate the indulgence.
Okay. There are some people that are not able to be here later in the week, so I'm going to call first on Tom Hewson and Scott Wiseman.
Madam Chair, while they're coming up, can I just mention that we are calling a stakeholder meeting?
Senator Anderson, yes.
Senate File 192, and Don Jarofsky from my office has passed out these little slips of paper. So I just want to encourage any interested parties to attend, and that includes senators, of course, are welcome to be there. Of course, we can't have so many that we have a quorum. Just a few senators would be great. But it's Monday at 10 o'clock in this room, so we'd welcome people who are interested in having a discussion about more of the details.
Okay. Who will begin?
Madam Chair, we're going to flip it around a little bit. I'm Scott Wiseman, and I'll go first if it's all right with the chair.
Certainly, Mr. Wiseman.
Thank you, ma'am. Good afternoon. My name is Scott Wiseman. I hold the position of Vice President for the Midwest Region for the Center for Energy and Economic Development, or CEED, C-E-E-D. CEED would like to applaud the sponsors of these bills for addressing a very serious issue and opening up a stakeholder process to receive input from all the parties. CEED's membership includes many of the nation's major coal-burning utilities, coal-hauling railroads, coal companies, barge and trucking companies, and manufacturers that supply these industries. In addition to this broad industry coalition, the United Mine Workers, the United Transportation Union, and Unions for Jobs and the Environment are non-dues-paying members of this group. Many of CEED's members do a significant amount of business in Minnesota, and that is why we are here today. Global climate change has been a central issue in CEED's advocacy efforts. Climate change policy cannot be separated from broader energy security, economic development, and environmental policies. Policies to achieve the goal of reducing or avoiding greenhouse gas emissions manifest themselves at a time when electricity demand in the United States continues to mount. Nationwide, the ability to provide a reliable supply of electricity is becoming increasingly difficult, according to the National Electricity Reliability Council, or NERC. NERC projects that the available installed capacity margin will decline nationally from approximately 18% in 2005 to 7% in 2015. For general reliability planning purposes, NERC recommends a national reserve margin of 11% and a 15% reserve margin in the Midwest region to ensure a safe and stable supply of electricity. Even under NERC's base case scenario that assumes no mandatory greenhouse gas regulations, some regions of the country will slip under the desired safe reserve margins within the next few years. Clearly, we can expect that regulation of utility greenhouse gas emissions will further exacerbate the situation. According to forecasts by the United States Energy Information Agency, or EIA, and others, some of the most severe federal greenhouse gas emissions mandates would reduce electricity supply by 7% in 2020 and 8% in 2025. I think we can safely anticipate that rigorous, immediate greenhouse gas reductions caused by state regulation would bring similar results. Having an abundant supply of affordable electricity will promote economic growth in Minnesota. Lower energy costs translate into stronger state economic development. The cost of electricity not only promotes economic development, but also profoundly affects the lives of millions of Americans. For those living on low or fixed incomes, energy costs consume 20 to 46% of total household income. Given the demonstrated linkage between household income and health, surges in energy costs can be expected to damage the quality of life of 1 in 3 American households with an annual income of $30,000 or less. Both bills under consideration today have implications on how Minnesota copes with energy supply and economic development. SEED asked this panel, as the stakeholder process is going to do, to carefully consider all the components included in the legislation and all of the impacts that are a result of it. Other states and Congress have undergone or are undergoing similar exercises presently or in the last few years. As mentioned earlier today, the governor of Illinois and the governor of Wisconsin have convened special climate panels to receive input from all stakeholders and recommend various courses of action. The air agencies in several upper Midwestern states, including Minnesota, have just signed a memorandum of understanding to develop a registry of greenhouse gas emissions to begin tallying an inventory beginning at the end of this year. Elsewhere, without significant stakeholder input, the California legislature last year passed a bill calling for the state to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to 1990 levels by 2020. California state agencies are now going through a rulemaking process to figure out how to meet this target, given the state's huge economy and rapid population growth. Apparently, that state's experience with deregulated electricity and its market a few years ago failed to serve as a sufficient example of what can happen when laws are made without input from a broad array of interested and knowledgeable participants. New England and other northeastern states convened a stakeholder process in 2004 and developed a regional plan for reducing carbon emissions from electric utilities. Again, that was referred to earlier. Initial proposals required reductions of up to 25% below 1990 emission levels. After 3 years of study and debate, the northeastern states agreed to freeze utility emissions at current levels for the next 10 years, and then to require a 10% reduction by 2020. Approaches undertaken by other states have been cautious and recognize that energy from fossil fuels drives the economy. That fact is important to remember when reading Sections 1, 2, and 3 of Article 5 of the governor's proposal. That's of major concern to generation stakeholders and could have a profound effect on the Minnesota economy. Future technologies promise to greatly reduce or even eliminate coal's contribution to global warming. But these technologies, such as sequestering carbon dioxide underground, need time to fully mature and become cost-effective. Today, I urge you, as shepherds of an important policy decision, to carefully consider all the data that you'll get in the stakeholder process and all the data you can get your hands on. SEED would be excited to be part of this process. And as part of the effort, I've got with me today Mr. Tom Houston of Energy Ventures Analysis Incorporated, an energy industry consulting firm out of Arlington, Virginia. He's going to speak for a couple minutes about some policy recommendations that may be worth considering. After Tom's remarks, we'll be happy to take questions. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Houston.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Houston. I'm a principal at Energy Ventures Analysis. We're a consulting firm located in Virginia. We do work for most of the major utilities in the United States, most of the major fuel suppliers, transporters, do a lot of work for public utility commissions, equipment vendors, and major research and development outfits. We've been working on greenhouse gases for several years. Needless to say, we recognize the challenges that you all are facing in controlling greenhouse gas emissions. Unlike our sulfur dioxide and mercury issues that were discussed later, carbon dioxide is much more difficult because it's spread out much more throughout several different areas of the economy. Roughly in Minnesota, according to EPA, 36% of your CO2 emissions come from the power sector. 34% come from the transportation sector, and about 28% come from the residential, commercial, and industrial sectors. So therefore, to develop a comprehensive approach, you need to address emissions that come from a wide number of sources. On top of that, of course, is that we are a carbon-based economy, and Minnesota is growing. There are going to be more people. There's going to be more demand. In our analysis by 2015, power demand is projected to reach 25% more than today's levels. and by 2020, the demand will be 40% higher. These are even with your aggressive energy conservation measures that are that you have been put in place. So the questions that we need to do is, how do we go from here? How do we address this issue? How do we control emissions? Obviously, in something like the transportation sector, we're working on hybrid cars. We're working on renewable fuels and trying to improve fuel efficiency standards. I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about the utility sector and about some of the approaches that we're working on there. Obviously, we're trying to be able to burn coal more efficiently. We're trying to do that by new technologies. Many of these technologies will only be available to new entrants. In other words, it's something we can't go back and retrofit. We also are working on carbon capture and sequestration technologies to be able to remove carbon dioxide from flue gas. Currently, we do have a technology that's in place in four power plants in the United States today, in which we use a methyl ethylamine scrubber, which can remove approximately 90% of the carbon dioxide. Unfortunately, it costs roughly about $100 a ton of CO2 removed. To put it into equivalent, that's about 10 cents per kilowatt hour just for carbon dioxide reductions alone. Given your average cost of 6.55 cents, needless to say, I think it would have a significant impact. So what we're trying to do is trying to come up with, obviously, more effective measures than that. Oh, the one reason why it's more very cost-effective, why it's so costly, is in these four plants, it takes about 75% of the output of the plant to capture 90% of all the streams. So you could imagine your 100-megawatt plant would all of a sudden only be able to supply 25 megawatts. So needless to say, it's a challenge. So we're working on new ways. One of the ways we're working on is to be able to, instead of using air for combustion, use oxygen, which would reduce the amount of nitrogen in the gas, make the carbon dioxide easier to strip away. We are working on future gen, which is an way to take IGCC, very different from the IGCC technology today, and to make hydrogen as opposed to carbon monoxide, which is what we try to do in IGCC. However, unfortunately, both these technology approaches do require or more set aside for new plants, although our first oxygen plant is going to be in a 23-megawatt plant in Ohio. They're very expensive, and we hope to be able to improve them. And looking at what we hope to do with flue gas is we hope to find something other than the means, go to different reagents, go to membranes. And what we have is we have a long-term plan in terms of major agencies. The Department of Energy is working on this. EPA is working on this. EPRI, which is the research and development arm of the electric utilities, working on this. I would say that given the approaches that we see, is that we're looking at probably beyond 2020 before some of these alternatives will be available. And so the question that faces you all is a matter of timing, too, which is, We can't set aside these very strict requirements until we have the technologies being able to achieve them. And it's going to take time. So what do we do in the interim? What can we do? We often talk about low-hanging fruit in terms of what can we do cheaply and quickly. One of the things, if you look at, there's a EPA study that was done in 2004 that looked at trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Remember, what you're focused on is we keep on talking about carbon dioxide. Well, there are other greenhouse gases also, which actually have greater global warming potential than carbon dioxide. And what we're looking at is perhaps being able to do things at landfills and capturing methane from landfill gases and use it for power generation. We're looking at being able to capture methane from animal management. Obviously, there's a lot of manure that ends up as methane. But by far, the cheapest way we've found so far is planting trees. Mother Nature does a much better job at removing CO2 than what we've been able to, and a lot cheaper, too. Roughly, planting trees is roughly $1 to $8 a ton, which is, you know, $1 to $8 a megawatt hour. It's at 0.1 to 0.8 cents per kilowatt hour. So one of the things that I would recommend that you look at is you are all in a very different situation than those states that we heard about earlier, like California and the Northeast. They have very different generation mixes. Here in Minnesota, 64% of your in-state generation comes from coal. If you look at the REGI states, you won't find any states that have anywhere close to that as far as the amount of coal. They have a lot of oil, which they were able to displace using gas. They had old gas plants that could go to gas combined cycle plants. They had a lot cheaper alternatives than the types of alternatives that you're facing here. So it's not as simple as, you know, just trying to adopt what California does. There's only two coal-fired power plants in all of California, and they're pretty small. So you have another set of unique challenges. And so going through the stakeholder process, I think you will probably learn a lot concerning what some of these alternatives are. But I would suggest that you keep your mind open in terms of looking at offsets, because they are by far a lot cheaper than some of the alternatives that we're looking at in terms of going to lower carbon fuels or trying to remove carbon dioxide out of the flue gases. I think that covers, a lot. What I wanted to say, and one last thing, is if you wanted to understand about Europe, we always hear, well, we're doing it because, you know, Europe took the step first. One thing that you all need to think about in terms of Europe is they're not talking about as big a step as you are here in Minnesota. As it turns out, 1990 was a great base year for them, because in 1990 to 1995, their emissions dropped significantly as Eastern European economies were captured and put to more efficiency. So they got a lot of efficiency and a lot of reductions by just replacing. You do not have that luxury. So if there are any questions, I'd be more than glad to try to answer them.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Well, I appreciate you coming before us today, but I really don't appreciate Mr. Wiseman's comments about the poor and all this. We spent the last month and a half, it seems like, you know, hearing about, you know, a renewable energy standard that, you know, now all of a sudden 25% is pretty attainable, but the transmission is a problem. And in that process, we've learned that the national electric grid seems to be in major catastrophe and facing some real problems. So you guys seem like pretty bright guys to me. I'm surprised you're not, you know, maybe working on that problem a little more. Because I think we can produce the energy. It seems to me that getting it places is going to be more of a problem. I guess that's more of a comment. But I do have a question. Is that you guys that are running that ad, coal.com or something, powerbycoal.com, or some of your affiliates?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Wiseman?
No.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if either one of you gentlemen would like to answer this question. Do you have any idea how many new coal plants are proposed around the country that are not IGCC or are capable of sequestering CO2?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, we do track announcements. We are currently tracking, I believe it's 153 announced coal-fired stations, of which approximately, as I remember, about 17% of that capacity was IGCC.
Okay. So, Madam Chair.
Senator Anderson.
I understand your point. There's maybe between Senator Tomasoni's approach of just phasing out all the old coal plants or getting to the technology to sequester the CO2, which maybe we're not at. In the meantime, do you think it's responsible to continue to build 153 new plants? Maybe that's a rhetorical question. How much emissions do you think, additional greenhouse gas emissions, would come from those 153 plants, and how many trees would you have to plant to offset those?
Madam,
Mr. Houston,
and Commissioner Senator Anderson. First of all, as we know, when people announce plants and when people build plants, there are sometimes a difference. There's also, of course, the timing of when plants are being built. And, of course, there's the issue when you build a plant, that doesn't necessarily mean that there are some older facilities that are less efficient that will be being retired. Obviously, the types of technologies that we're talking about in terms of the ones that are being proposed are much more efficient than the types of technologies that are in place today. And so to say that they're just going to be continuing to add on, as I'm not sure, would be technically correct. In addition to that, of course, that's just the coal side of the equation. I mean, we are also looking at, new nuclear plants. If we're very serious about global warming, I would say that nuclear power, in terms of the analysis we had when we were looking at in the Northeast to achieve some of the very aggressive limitations, and it all depends on what sort of limitations you're trying to achieve. But in the cases where we're trying to get below 1990 levels, we were talking about having to build 53% more nuclear capacity in the Northeast and build two new nuclear plants each year in order to maintain those CO2 levels.
Madam Chair, maybe I didn't understand your first answer, but you suggested that it wouldn't actually add to greenhouse gas emissions to build 153 new coal plants because they're more efficient and they might replace some old plants.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Wiseman.
If I could address that. I think Mr. Usen stated that the newer technologies and the newer plants are more efficient. There's still going to be an emission of greenhouse gases, but you improve it over perhaps an older plant that might be replaced. And I think that's a responsible goal, I believe.
Well, Madam Chair, I think you started by laying out the increased demand that you're projecting. So I would assume that most of these would not replace old capacity, but would supplement old plants.
Madam Chair, I think it's kind of a mix.
Mr. Wise.
Madam Chair, I'd say that, first of all, there are some that are going to be replaced. There are generally, we have a lot of very small, very old, very inefficient units that are going to be phased out, that are going to be retired. And so all I was trying to say was it's that some of the emissions, it's not just adding the emissions from the 150 plants, it's not going to be 153 plants. It's going to be a smaller number than that. And then also that it's not going to be just their emissions. They're going to be offsetting some emissions that in terms of the electricity that they displace. And probably in all likelihood, I would agree with your earlier comment that there's going to be greenhouse gas emissions that are legislation that will be adopted. And so that when we look into the future, we're likely to have we probably will have controls. My guess, if 2020, we'll have controls on those plants.
Madam Chair, I think it kind of proves the point that we're trying to make in our bill that maybe by 2020 we'll have a solution to being able to use coal in a way that's environmentally responsible. But in the meantime, we don't, as far as these gentlemen are telling us. Yet they're proposing, I don't know what a percent increase this would be to the fleet of coal plants around the nation before those regulations are in place, which is why I think it's important to try to stabilize where we are now. That might be the first thing that we need to do so that there's not a rush to try to build a bunch of more new plants that will come in under the wire before we have regulation in place, which I think everyone agrees will happen.
Mr. Houston.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, obviously of those plants, I believe that there's one in Minnesota that I'm aware of. I think most of the plants, of course, are dealing with outside. So as far as your comment in terms as it deals with Minnesota, obviously you have adopted a very, aggressive renewable portfolio standard.
Madam Chair, can I just ask one more
Senator
question?
Anderson.
Can you comment on the technology that is proposed for the Mesaba plant to use a pipeline to transport CO2 across to North Dakota? Do you have any opinion about that?
Mr. Houston.
Chairman, Senator Anderson, I can only, first of all, I do not know specifically about Mesaba Ridge. I can talk about IGCC in general.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess what I'm getting at is you said that you don't You don't believe the technology is there yet to sequester CO2, but do you believe the technology is there to sequester it using a pipeline method of shipping it somewhere else?
Mr. Houston.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Anderson. First of all, I was talking about existing plants. Obviously, Mesa Bridge is a new plant. I did say about IGCC, one of the things that happens with IGCC technologies as we deal with carbon monoxide is that we can remove carbon dioxide that is created in the syngas, strip it off for a much lower cost than what we could do once we burn the syngas and create carbon dioxide. That's when we get into the $100 a ton. Mm-hmm. So the question is how much carbon dioxide is going to be created in the syngas. Generally speaking, as far as IGCC is concerned, we're trying to maximize the amount of carbon monoxide because we can burn it and create power from it and then create the heat from it. When we create carbon dioxide in the syngas, we're actually have in essence overcooked it, and it is not something that we're trying to optimize. But it's, with that said, there is probably up to 20% of the carbon might be converted up to carbon dioxide that could be removed in an IGCC plant by stripping it. Then you have to then compress it to be able to ship it, and that will also cost you money. And so you will have captured it, but then you're going to have to put in a form that then you can ship it.
So, Madam Chair, just to follow up, so do you believe it's financially viable to do that at this point with a new IGCC plant?
Mr. Houston.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, first of all, that has everything to do with the Public Utility Commission and at what cost. You know, right now, in terms of the general selection, is that people have found that the supercritical pulverized coal unit is cheaper and often is more has been projected to have better energy efficiencies than the IGCC plant with subbituminous coals.
Okay, I'll stop there. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Rick Lancaster.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rick Lancaster. Thanks for including me on your agenda. I am from the Twin Cities area, but I'm going to be out of town Thursday, so thank you very much. I'm Vice President of Generation at Great River Energy. We're a not-for-profit electric cooperative. Our headquarters is in Elk River. We provide electricity at wholesale to 28 distribution cooperatives, who in turn serve 600,000 consumers in Minnesota. And our member service areas cover about 60% of the state. About 1.5 million people live in the homes that we serve. We're a member of the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. They're having their annual meeting in town this week, and you've probably seen a lot of them around the building today, and they were in this room. At least some of them are. Let me say first that we're very concerned about global warming. We have a goal at GRE of reducing our CO2 emissions to year 2000 levels by 2020. We've been a leader in renewable energy development. Last year, the renewable energy requirement in Minnesota for electric utilities was 2%. Our actual renewable energy production was about 4%. We'll have over 10% renewables by 2009, and we're on track to have 20% renewables by 2020 and 25% by 2025. I know that Minnesotans want the global warming problem to be addressed, but I also know they expect it to be addressed with the lights on. I'm very concerned about provisions of these two bills that, to me, show a disregard for electric reliability. I'm particularly concerned about provisions of Section 6 of Senator Anderson's bill, Senate File 192, and it's Section 6 in the Delete Everything Amendment also, that would prohibit the construction of natural gas, fuel oil, or coal-fired power plants and would prohibit the import of power from outside the state while a planning process takes place to implement a CO2 cap and trade program. These prohibitions would occur regardless of the growing demand for electricity in our state. The planning process could be a lengthy process. If we are prohibited from building even natural gas peaking plants during that process, the reliability of the electric system in this state will be severely impaired. We at GRE have a natural gas power plant under construction today, just north of Cambridge, and its construction would be halted if this bill were to pass before the project was complete. The provision of Senate File 192 that would halt the import of power from outside the state if it is from a new natural gas, oil, or coal plant would be very difficult to implement. Our electric power system is an interconnected grid that stretches from the Atlantic Ocean to the Rocky Mountains, from Saskatchewan to Florida, synchronized at 60 cycles per second, alternating current. We rely on power from outside the state to keep the lights on here in Minnesota. When we buy power from it's called the MISO market, Midwest Independent System Operator market, we don't typically know which plant or plants it comes from. For this reason, a federal cap and trade program would make more sense to me than a state program would. I believe there are provisions in both bills that are aimed at Big Stone 2. We would be a partner in Big Stone 2, so let me make a few comments about it. Big Stone 2, if it came online today, would be the most efficient large coal-fired power plant in the United States and therefore the lowest emitter of CO2 per megawatt hour. It's what's known as a supercritical pulverized coal plant. It costs extra to build, but it's 20% more efficient than a typical coal plant. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in a report that your staff have already handed out, has identified supercritical pulverized coal plants with CO2 capture as part of a carbon-constrained future in the world. This is the same panel of government scientists who've said there's a 90% chance that humans are responsible for global warming. Their view of a carbon-constrained future includes plants like Big Stone 2 with CO2 capture. I'm quite certain that Big Stone 2, if we're allowed to build it, will one day be retrofitted with CO2 capture technology. That technology is not commercially available today on the scale that we would need it at Big Stone 2. The plants that Mr. Hewson was talking about are very small plants. But we are participating in research with the Electric Power Research Institute, also with the University of North Dakota, to develop CO2 capture technology in ways that can be applied to large-scale power plants. If you have been told that once Big Stone 2 has been built, we'll never be able to capture CO2 from it, then you've been told wrong. There are things Minnesota can do. You've already done a lot this year when you passed the 25% renewable energy standard. I believe this is the best single thing that the Minnesota legislature can do to address global warming at this time. The 25% renewable energy standard was preceded by the wind integration study. Although I believe the results of that study are sometimes misinterpreted, it was a necessary precursor to the 25% bill to assure us all that 25% renewables would not degrade the reliability of the very complex and important electric power system that we all rely on. Let me just say a quick word about offsets. That's in Article 5 of Senate File 145. It's not clear from that bill what an offset is. You heard some questions about that earlier. How would a qualified offset be defined? Are such offsets realistically available now in insufficient quantities, or would they take time to implement? Until you get answers to that question as part of a comprehensive plan for addressing climate change, you run the risk of creating a system that will not be workable. So, in conclusion, global warming legislation should be preceded by a comprehensive understanding of the effects it will have on the electric power system, just as the 25% renewable energy standard was preceded by the wind integration study. I urge you to develop a comprehensive climate change reduction plan through a process that includes all stakeholders, not just electric utilities, regulatory agencies, and environmental groups, but also businesses and low-income consumers whose competitiveness and livelihoods may be affected by the outcome. So I agree with and support your desire to address the global warming problem, but like most Minnesotans, I'd like to see you do it with the lights on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Osteen.
I just spent the weekend reading your brochure, your newsletter or something. I was very impressed with your building that you're building with all the with a wind turbine and solar panels, and it's very, very impressive. But, you know, having sat through a lot of the debate on the wind generation, I got to say that it wasn't a real negative picture in your brochure. It sounded, you know, you talked a little bit about the standards in wind generation and those kinds of things. So I'm just wondering, you know, when I'm hearing concerns from electric generators, and I they're valid concerns, but in your PR piece, it doesn't necessarily reflect what was told at this table. So then I'm wondering about this, too, I have to wonder, because I'm hearing almost two different stories. And if you have a concern in your PR, put it in your PR, you know. So I don't want to just hear it here, but I want to hear it other places. Because it almost seemed on one side we were told, oh, we can't do this, we can't do that. And then it's kind of sugar-coated in a brochure. So I just would ask for some consistency maybe.
Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, we have absolutely no problem with wind power. We support the 25% renewable energy mandate. We have wind power under contract right now. What I'm concerned about in these bills is provisions that would prohibit us from building other types of power plants. Because, you know, the wind doesn't blow all the time, and a way to manage that is to build natural gas peaking plants, such as the one we're building just north of Cambridge. Those plants start quickly. They ramp up and down easily. We can shut them down if the wind starts up again. Those plants are very necessary, and we use them right now to complement the wind power that we have. We do that at Trimont, where we have a 100-megawatt wind farm and a 500-megawatt peaking plant. So, but this bill would prohibit us from building even peaking plants, and I just don't know how we're going to manage the system and keep the lights on if we're prohibited even from doing that or from building other types of power plants.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Madam Chair, I would just take issue with Mr. Lancaster's characterization of my bill. It doesn't prohibit the building of a new coal plant or a new natural gas plant. What it prohibits is increased emissions, and so they'd have to be offset in order for those plants to be built.
Mr. Lancaster.
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I didn't mean to say it prohibits them forever. It does prohibit the construction of them while the process is pending, while the rules are being developed, while the cap and trade system is being put in place. So I'd be concerned about that because we got to keep the lights on in the meantime.
Senator Dipple.
But thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson's statement still stands, though. You know, if there's no net increase in emissions, you know, knock yourself out. That's, you know, that's what the language, the clear reading of her bill says. I would also add we're going to be getting to the efficiencies at some point and hopefully, you know, getting to some ability to, you know, to do some more and better conservation that will also help circumstances out tremendously in terms of the future need.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble.
Mr. Lancaster.
I understand what you're saying. We, however, are growing 3% a year. Our load is to serve our consumers, sometimes four, sometimes more, depending on the weather. And we need some power plants that produce CO2 in order to track that load growth. Later on, when some of the technologies are developed that will allow us to capture CO2 from our existing coal plants, we can make 90% reduction in the emissions from our coal plants. So when those technologies are available, we'll be capable of making huge reductions in our CO2 emissions. I'm talking about in the short term. In Section 6 of Senator Anderson's bill, it says no person shall construct within the state a new large energy facility
that would contribute to the statewide power sector carbon dioxide emissions until the cap-and-trade system is in place. That is very significant to us, and it says we can't build power plants to serve our growth and load.
Madam Senator,
there's an exception, section that needs to be read in conjunction with the prohibition. Exception for facilities that offset emissions, and then there's, you know, several sections that follow.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, that gets to my comment about the offsets. That it's not clear how the offsets would be defined, where they come from. Are there enough offsets? I think some time needs to be granted to figure out the answers to those questions.
And I would suggest, Senator Anderson, you look at that with your stakeholder groups, because that may be a real obstacle.
Well, Madam Chair, absolutely. I think we need to have a very good discussion about how emissions could be offset. But I just want to be clear that that's our intention, is to that it says that.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Lancaster.
You.
John Knapp.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Knapp, and I represent Partners for Affordable Energy. Partners for Affordable Energy supports the goal of cost-effective global greenhouse gas emission reductions, but we are concerned that Senate File 192, as currently drafted, fails to address some important realities of today's energy environment. Partners for Affordable Energy is a regional coalition that is an advocate for low-cost, reliable, and environmentally compatible coal-based electricity. Founding members include coal producers and electric service providers, including utilities and rural electric cooperatives in both North Dakota and Minnesota. Although many of Minnesota's electric utilities are actively engaged in developing renewable energy sources, they still rely on coal for their baseload generation needs. That reality is one of the considerations that must be recognized as you debate greenhouse gas legislation. Another reality is that state-level action on greenhouse gas reduction will have little impact on atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide. Much of the greenhouse gas problem comes from outside U.S. borders, where the increasing and uncontrolled emissions of developing countries such as China and India render state-level action or even regional action of minimal impact. Both House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid have called for federal legislation on climate change during 2007. With federal legislation imminent, state-by-state or regional efforts to draft climate change legislation might conflict with a federal program. As you know, utilities are not the only source of man-made carbon emissions. According to the EPA's most recent greenhouse gas inventory, about 33% of man-made emissions come from electric generation, and 28% come from the transportation sector. The remaining 39% comes from the industrial, residential, agricultural, and commercial sectors. An effective emissions reduction policy must address all major emission sources, not just electric generating facilities. It is also important to recognize that actual emission reduction performance can only be as good as the available technology. Emission reduction targets are moot if technology does not exist or is too costly to enable utilities to comply without significant rate increases. While many promising technologies are currently being tested, we are still some years away from a widely applicable and commercially cost-effective technology to capture or reduce carbon dioxide emissions. While renewable energy certainly has a place in the overall solution for carbon reduction, there is broad agreement among energy experts that renewables cannot supply a significant portion of our baseload generation needs at an acceptable level of reliability and cost. Baseload generation requires 24/7 power, and not all renewables may be that dependable. Additionally, cost is an important issue that should not be overlooked. Minnesota's economy has benefited significantly from relatively low energy costs, which have provided a competitive advantages for businesses locating or expanding here. Individual ratepayers also benefit from these low costs. It also should be noted that there has not yet been an economic study that analyzes the effect of a state greenhouse gas initiative. Article 5, Section 4 of Senate File 145 calls for an independent expert to conduct a structured series of stakeholder meetings to review potential policies and initiatives that could be undertaken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Importantly, this climate change action plan should and must include a cost-benefit analysis, which will provide useful guidance in developing state strategies on greenhouse gas reduction. We believe that Minnesota's energy future must ensure a future energy supply that is environmentally responsible, but is also affordable and reliable. We look forward to working with the authors of this legislation as it proceeds through the committee and the stakeholder processes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Knapp. Any questions? Okay, thank you. Is Tony Quillis still here? No. Does Molly Schultz wish to address us?
She just stepped out.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of the testifiers, unless there's anybody in the audience who would like to speak to us briefly today. We are pretty booked on Thursday for testifiers, so if anybody would like to address us today. Seeing no one, the meeting is adjourned.